This is Audible.
Audible Inc. presents The Blind Watchmaker, Why the Evidence of Evolution Reveals a Universe Without Design. Written by Richard Dawkins. Narrated by Richard Dawkins and Lala Ward.
Preface written for the 1986 edition. This book is written in the conviction that our own existence once presented the greatest of all mysteries, but that it is a mystery no longer, because it is solved. Darwin and Wallace solved it, though we shall continue to add footnotes to their solution for a while yet. I wrote the book because I was surprised that so many people seemed not only unaware of the elegant and beautiful solution to this deepest of problems, but, incredibly, in many cases actually unaware that there was a problem in the first place. The problem is that of complex design. The computer on which I wrote these words had an information storage capacity of about 64 kilobytes. One byte is used to hold each character of text. The computer was consciously designed and deliberately manufactured. The brain, with which you are understanding my words, is an array of some 10 million kiloneurons. Many of these billions of nerve cells have each more than 1,000 electric wires connecting them to other neurons. Moreover, at the molecular genetic level, every single one of more than 1 trillion cells in the body contains about 1,000 times as much precisely coded digital information as my entire computer. The complexity of living organisms is matched by the elegant efficiency of their apparent design. If anyone doesn't agree that this amount of complex design cries out for an explanation, I give up. No, on second thoughts, I don't give up, because one of my aims in the book is to convey something of the sheer wonder of biological complexity to those whose eyes have not been opened to it. But, having built up the mystery, my other main aim is to remove it again by explaining the solution. Explaining is a difficult art. You can explain something so that your reader understands the words, and you can explain something so that the reader feels it in the marrow of his bones. To do the latter, it sometimes isn't enough to lay the evidence before the reader in a dispassionate way. You have to become an advocate and use the tricks of the advocate's trade. This book is not a dispassionate scientific treatise. Other books on Darwinism are, and many of them are excellent and informative and should be read in conjunction with this one. Far from being dispassionate, it has to be confessed that in parts this book is written with a passion which, in a professional scientific journal, might excite comment. Certainly it seeks to inform, but it also seeks to persuade, and even, one can specify aims without presumption, to inspire. I want to inspire the reader with a vision of our own existence as, on the face of it, a spine-chilling mystery, and simultaneously to convey the full excitement of the fact that it is a mystery with an elegant solution which is within our grasp. More, I want to persuade the reader not just that the Darwinian worldview happens to be true, but that it is the only known theory that could, in principle, solve the mystery of our existence. This makes it a doubly satisfying theory. A good case can be made that Darwinism is true not just on this planet, but all over the universe wherever life may be found. In one respect, I plead to distance myself from professional advocates. A lawyer or a politician is paid to exercise his passion and his persuasion on behalf of a client or a cause in which he may not privately believe. I have never done this, and I never shall. I may not always be right, but I care passionately about what is true, and I never say anything that I do not believe to be right. I remember being shocked when visiting a university debating society to debate with creationists. At dinner after the debate, I was placed next to a young woman who had made a relatively powerful speech in favour of creationism. She clearly couldn't be a creationist, so I asked her to tell me honestly why she had done it. She freely admitted that she was simply practising her debating skills and found it more challenging to advocate a position in which she did not believe. Apparently, it is common practice in university debating societies for speakers simply to be told on which side they are to speak. Their own beliefs don't come into it. I had come a long way to perform the disagreeable task of public speaking because I believed in the truth of the motion that I'd been asked to propose. When I discovered that members of the society were using the motion as a vehicle for playing arguing games, I resolved to decline future invitations from debating societies that encourage insincere advocacy on issues where scientific truth is at stake. For reasons that are not entirely clear to me, Darwinism seems more in need of advocacy than similarly established truths in other branches of science.
Many of us have no grasp of quantum theory, or Einstein's theories of special and general relativity, but this does not in itself lead us to oppose these theories. Darwinism, unlike Einsteinism, seems to be regarded as fair game for critics with any degree of ignorance. Perhaps one trouble with Darwinism is that, as Jacques Monod perceptively remarked, everybody thinks he understands it. It is indeed a remarkably simple theory, childishly so, one would have thought, in comparison with almost all of physics and mathematics. In essence, it amounts simply to the idea that non-random reproduction, where there is hereditary variation, has consequences that are far-reaching if there is time for them to be cumulative. But we have good grounds for believing that this simplicity is deceptive. Never forget that, simple as the theory may seem, nobody thought of it until Darwin and Wallace, in the mid-19th century, nearly 200 years after Newton's Principia, and more than 2,000 years after Eratosthenes measured the Earth. How could such a simple idea go so long undiscovered by thinkers of the caliber of Newton, Galileo, Descartes, Leibniz, Hume, and Aristotle? Why did it have to wait for two Victorian naturalists? What was wrong with philosophers and mathematicians that they overlooked it? And how can such a powerful idea go still largely unabsorbed into popular consciousness? It is almost as if the human brain was specifically designed to misunderstand Darwinism and to find it hard to believe. Take, for instance, the issue of chance, often dramatized as blind chance. The great majority of people that attack Darwinism leap with almost unseemly eagerness to the mistaken idea that there is nothing other than random chance in it. Since living complexity embodies the very antithesis of chance, if you think that Darwinism is tantamount to chance, you'll obviously find it easy to refute Darwinism. One of the intentions of this book is to destroy this eagerly believed myth that Darwinism is a theory of chance. Another way in which we seem predisposed to disbelieve Darwinism is that our brains are built to deal with events on radically different timescales from those that characterize evolutionary change. We are equipped to appreciate processes that take seconds, minutes, years, or at most decades to complete. Darwinism is a theory of cumulative processes so slow that they take between thousands and millions of decades to complete. All our intuitive judgments of what is probable turn out to be wrong by many orders of magnitude. Our well-tuned apparatus of skepticism and subjective probability theory misfires by huge margins because it is tuned, ironically by evolution itself, to work within a lifetime of a few decades. It requires effort of the imagination to escape from the prison of familiar timescale. A third respect in which our brains seem predisposed to resist Darwinism stems from our great success as creative designers. Our world is dominated by feats of engineering and works of art. We are entirely accustomed to the idea that complex elegance is an indicator of premeditated, crafted design. This is probably the most powerful reason for the belief held by the vast majority of people that have ever lived in some kind of supernatural deity. It took a very large leap of the imagination for Darwin and Wallace to see that, contrary to all intuition, there is another way, and, once you've understood it, a far more plausible way for complex design to arise out of primeval simplicity. A leap of the imagination so large that to this day many people seem still unwilling to make it. It is the main purpose of this book to help the reader to make this leap.
Authors naturally hope that their books will have lasting rather than ephemeral impact. But any advocate, in addition to putting the timeless part of his case, must also respond to contemporary advocates of opposing or apparently opposing points of view. There is a risk that some of these arguments, however hotly they may rage today, will seem terribly dated in decades to come. The paradox has often been noted that the first edition of The Origin of Species makes a better case than the sixth. This is because Darwin felt obliged in his later editions to respond to contemporary criticisms of the first edition, criticisms which now seem so dated that the replies to them merely get in the way and in places even mislead. Nevertheless, the temptation to ignore fashionable contemporary criticisms that one suspects of being 9 days' wonders is a temptation that should not be indulged, for reasons of courtesy not just to the critics, but to their otherwise confused readers. Though I have my own private ideas on which chapters of my book will eventually prove ephemeral for this reason, the reader, and time, must judge. I am distressed to find that some women friends, fortunately not many, treat the use of the impersonal masculine pronoun as if it showed intention to exclude them. If there were any excluding to be done, happily there isn't, I think I would sooner exclude men. But when I once tentatively tried referring to my abstract reader as she, a feminist denounced me for patronizing condescension. I ought to say he or she and his or her. That is easy to do if you don't care about language, but then if you don't care about language, you don't deserve readers of either sex. Here I have returned to the normal conventions of English pronouns. I may refer to the reader as he, but I no more think of my readers as specifically male than a French speaker thinks of a table as female. As a matter of fact, I believe I do, more often than not, think of my readers as female, but that is my personal affair, and I'd hate to think that such considerations impinged on how I use my native language. Introduction to the 2006 edition. The Blind Watchmaker was first published in 1986, and for an edition released in 2006, I was asked to add an introduction. All I had to do was list the ways, there surely had to be many, in which I should reform the book if I were writing it again today. Eagerly, chapter by chapter, I scanned for errors, misguidednesses, out-of-datenesses, incompletenesses. I genuinely wanted to find them, for science, whatever the frailties of its individual practitioners, is not naturally complacent and pays lip service to the ideal of progress through falsification. But alas, details aside, I can find no major thesis in these chapters that I would withdraw, nothing to justify the satisfying catharsis of a good recant. This does not mean, of course, that there is no more to be said. I could easily fill another 10 entirely new chapters on the perennially fascinating topic of evolutionary design. But that would be another book. Now that I think of it, it would be called Climbing Mount Improbable. Although each of the two books is self-sufficient and can be read on its own, it is also true that either could be read as a continuation of the other. The particular subject matter of the two books is different, just as all the chapters of the present book are different from each other, but the underlying theme is the same: Darwinism and design. To say that I do not apologize for this Darwinian continuity would be an understatement. Darwinism is a giant subject whose many faces are good for more books than could be finished in a full and satisfying career. Nor am I a professional science writer who, having done evolution, might be expected to turn his attention to physics or astronomy. Why should I? A historian can legitimately write more than one book about history rather than switch to classics or mathematics. A master chef produces yet another book on some new aspect of cooking, correctly reasoning that gardening is best left to master gardeners. Notwithstanding the relative shelf space allocated to the respective topics in bookshops, and understating again, Darwinism is a larger subject than either cookery or gardening. It is my subject, and it provides ample scope for one lifetime's expertise. Darwinism encompasses all of life, human, animal, plant, bacterial, and if I'm right in the last chapter of this book, extraterrestrial. It provides the only satisfying explanation for why we all exist, why we are the way that we are. It is the bedrock on which rest all the disciplines known as the humanities. I do not mean that history, literary criticism, and the law should be recast in a specifically Darwinian mold. Far from it, very far. But all human works are the products of brains. Brains are evolved data processing devices, and we shall misunderstand their works if we forget this fundamental fact. If more doctors understood Darwinism, humanity would not now be facing a crisis of antibiotic resistance. Darwinian evolution, as one reviewer has observed, is the most portentous natural truth that science has yet discovered. I'd add, or is likely to discover. Other books have appeared in the 20 years since The Blind Watchmaker was published, which I should like to have written, and which I would certainly draw upon were I to start the book again. Helena Cronin's beautifully written The Ant and the Peacock, and Matt Ridley's equally clear The Red Queen, would be bound to influence any rewriting of the chapter on sexual selection. Daniel Dennett's Darwin's Dangerous Idea would colour my historical and philosophical interpretations at all points, and his refreshing forthrightness would embolden my critical chapters. Mark Ridley's magisterial Evolution would be an ever-open source of instruction for me and my readers. Steven Pinker's The Language Instinct might have inspired me to tackle the subject of language from an evolutionary point of view, had he not already done it so well. The same applies to Darwinian Medicine, were it not for Randolph Nessie and George Williams's excellent book on the subject, albeit the title wished by the publishers upon the unfortunate authors is the perversely unhelpful Why We Get Sick. There are still those who seek to deny the truth of evolution, and there are disturbing signs that their influence is even growing, at least in local areas of the United States. Insofar as these backwoodsmen have arguments, they mostly center around the notion of design, which also happens to be the principal theme of The Blind Watchmaker. The book had finer ambitions than to serve as a reply to such arguments, but it is still true that anybody tempted by the arguments of creationists will find definitive refutations of them, I think all of them, in here. Pretend as they will to scientific credentials, the anti-evolution propagandists are always religiously motivated, even if they try to buy credibility by concealing the fact. In most cases, they know deep down what to believe because their parents recommended an ancient book that tells them what to believe. If the scientific evidence learned in adulthood contradicts the book, there must be something wrong with the scientific evidence. Since all radiometric dating methods agree that the Earth is thousands of millions of years old, something obviously has to be wrong with all radiometric dating methods. The holy book of childhood cannot be, must not be, wrong. There are grounds for hope, however. When The Blind Watchmaker was first published in the United States, Norton, the American publishers, sent me on a brief tour of the country, and I did a number of radio phone-ins. I had been warned to expect hostile questioning from fundamentalist listeners, and I confess I was looking forward to destroying their arguments. What actually happened was even better. The listeners who telephoned were genuinely interested in the subject of evolution. They were not hostile to it. They simply did not know anything about it. Instead of destroying arguments, I had the more constructive task of educating the innocent. It took only minutes to awaken them to the power of Darwinism as a convincing explanation of life. I got the impression that the only reason they had not seen its possibilities before was that the subject had been totally omitted from their education. Aside from some vague nonsense about monkeys, they simply didn't know what Darwinism was. I was reminded of the creationist student who, through some accident of the selection procedure, was once admitted to the zoology department at Oxford University. He had been educated at a small fundamentalist college in the United States and had emerged a simple young earth creationist. When he arrived in Oxford, he was encouraged to attend a course of lectures on evolution. At the end, he came up to the lecturer, who happened to be me, beaming with the primal joy of discovery. "Gee," he exulted, "this evolution, it really makes sense." It certainly does. In the words of a T-shirt, which an anonymous American reader was kind enough to send me, Evolution, the greatest show on earth, the only game in town. Chapter 1. Explaining the Very Improbable. We animals are the most complicated things in the known universe. The universe that we know, of course, is a tiny fragment of the actual universe. There may be yet more complicated objects than us on other planets, and some of them may already know about us. But this doesn't alter the point that I want to make. Complicated things everywhere deserve a very special kind of explanation. We want to know how they came into existence and why they are so complicated. The explanation, as I shall argue, is likely to be broadly the same for complicated things everywhere in the universe, the same for us, for chimpanzees, worms, oak trees, and monsters from outer space. On the other hand, it will not be the same for what I shall call simple things, such as rocks, clouds, rivers, galaxies, and quarks. These are the stuff of physics. Chimps and dogs and bats and cockroaches and people and worms and dandelions and bacteria and galactic aliens are the stuff of biology.
The difference is one of complexity of design. Biology is the study of complicated things that give the appearance of having been designed for a purpose. Physics is the study of simple things that do not tempt us to invoke design. At first sight, man-made artifacts like computers and cars will seem to provide exceptions. They are complicated and obviously designed for a purpose, yet they're not alive and they are made of metal and plastic rather than of flesh and blood. In this book, they will be firmly treated as biological objects. The reader's reaction to this may be to ask, yes, but are they really biological objects? Words are our servants, not our masters. For different purposes, we find it convenient to use words in different senses. Most cookery books class lobsters as fish.
Zoologists can become quite apoplectic about this, pointing out that lobsters could with greater justice call humans fish, since fish are far closer kin to humans than they are to lobsters. And talking of justice and lobsters, a court of law recently had to decide whether lobsters were insects or animals. It bore upon whether people should be allowed to boil them alive. Zoologically speaking, lobsters are certainly not insects. They are animals, but then so are insects, and so are we. There is little point in getting worked up about the way different people use words, although in my non-professional life, I am quite prepared to get worked up about people who boil lobsters alive. Cooks and lawyers need to use words in their own special ways, and so do I in this book.
Never mind whether cars and computers are really biological objects. The point is that if anything of that degree of complexity were found on a planet, we should have no hesitation in concluding that life existed or had once existed on that planet. Machines are the direct products of living objects. They derive their complexity and design from living objects, and they are diagnostic of the existence of life on a planet. The same goes for fossils, skeletons, and dead bodies.
We said that physics is the study of simple things, and this too may seem strange at first. Physics appears to be a complicated subject because the ideas of physics are difficult for us to understand. Our brains were designed to understand hunting and gathering, mating and child-rearing, a world of medium-sized objects moving in three dimensions at moderate speeds. We are ill-equipped to comprehend the very small and the very large, things whose duration is measured in picoseconds or giga-years. Particles that don't have position, forces and fields that we cannot see or touch, which we know of only because they affect things that we can see or touch.
We think that physics is complicated because it's hard for us to understand and because physics books are full of difficult mathematics. But the objects that physicists study are still basically simple objects. They are clouds of gas or tiny particles or lumps of uniform matter like crystals, with almost endlessly repeated atomic patterns. They do not, at least by biological standards, have intricate working parts. Even large physical objects like stars consist of a rather limited array of parts, more or less haphazardly arranged. The behavior of physical, non-biological objects is so simple that it is feasible to use existing mathematical language to describe it, which is why physics books are full of mathematics.
Physics books may be complicated, but physics books, like cars and computers, are the product of biological objects, human brains. The objects and phenomena that a physics book describes are simpler than a single cell in the body of its author. And the author consists of trillions of those cells, many of them different from each other, organized with intricate architecture and precision engineering into a working machine capable of writing a book. My trillions are American, like all my units. One American trillion is a million millions. An American billion is a thousand millions. Our brains are no better equipped to handle extremes of complexity than extremes of size and the other difficult extremes of physics. Nobody has yet invented the mathematics for describing the total structure and behavior of such an object as a physicist, or even of one of his cells. What we can do is understand some of the general principles of how living things work and why they exist at all. This was where we came in. We wanted to know why we and all other complicated things exist, and we can now answer that question in general terms, even without being able to comprehend the details of the complexity itself.
To take an analogy, most of us don't understand in detail how an airliner works. Probably its builders don't comprehend it fully either. Engine specialists don't in detail understand wings, and wing specialists understand engines only vaguely. Wing specialists don't even understand wings with full mathematical precision. They can predict how a wing will behave in turbulent conditions only by examining a model in a wind tunnel or a computer simulation, the sort of thing a biologist might do to understand an animal. But however incompletely we understand how an airliner works, we all understand by what general process it came into existence. It was designed by humans on drawing boards. Then other humans made the bits from the drawings, then lots more humans with the aid of other machines designed by humans, screwed, riveted, welded, or glued the bits together, each in its right place. The process by which an airliner came into existence is not fundamentally mysterious to us, because humans built it. The systematic putting together of parts to a purposeful design is something we know and understand, for we have experienced it at first hand, even if only with our childhood Meccano or Erector set. What about our own bodies? Each one of us is a machine, like an airliner, only much more complicated. Were we designed on a drawing board too, and were our parts assembled by a skilled engineer?
The answer is no. It is a surprising answer, and we have known and understood it for only a century or so. When Charles Darwin first explained the matter, many people either wouldn't or couldn't grasp it. I myself flatly refused to believe Darwin's theory when I first heard about it as a child. Almost everybody throughout history, up to the second half of the 19th century, has firmly believed in the opposite, the conscious designer theory. Many people still do, perhaps because the true Darwinian explanation of our own existence is still, remarkably, not a routine part of the curriculum of a general education. It is certainly very widely misunderstood. The watchmaker of my title is borrowed from a famous treatise by the 18th century theologian William Paley. His Natural Theology, or Evidences of the Existence and Attributes of the Deity Collected from the Appearances of Nature, published in 1802, is the best-known exposition of the argument from design, always the most influential of the arguments for the existence of a god. It is a book that I greatly admire, for in his own time its author succeeded in doing what I am struggling to do now. He had a point to make, he passionately believed in it, and he spared no effort to ram it home clearly. He had a proper reverence for the complexity of the living world, and he saw that it demands a very special kind of explanation. The only thing he got wrong, admittedly quite a big thing, was the explanation itself. He gave the traditional religious answer to the riddle, but he articulated it more clearly and convincingly than anybody had before. The true explanation is utterly different, and it had to wait for one of the most revolutionary thinkers of all time, Charles Darwin. Paley begins Natural Theology with a famous passage.
In crossing a heath, suppose I pitched my foot against a stone and were asked how the stone came to be there. I might possibly answer that, for anything I knew to the contrary, it had lain there forever. Nor would it perhaps be very easy to show the absurdity of this answer, but suppose I had found a watch upon the ground, and it should be inquired how the watch happened to be in that place. I should hardly think of the answer, which I had before given, that for anything I knew, the watch might have always been there.
Paley here appreciates the difference between natural physical objects like stones and designed and manufactured objects like watches. He goes on to expound the precision with which the cogs and springs of a watch are fashioned, and the intricacy with which they are put together. If we found an object such as a watch upon a heath, even if we didn't know how it had come into existence, its own precision and intricacy of design would force us to conclude
that the watch must have had a maker, that there must have existed, at some time and at some place or other, an artificer or artificers who formed it for the purpose which we find it actually to answer, who comprehended its construction and designed its use.
Nobody could reasonably dissent from this conclusion, Paley insists, yet that is just what the atheist in effect does when he contemplates the works of nature, for
every indication of contrivance, every manifestation of design which existed in the watch, exists in the works of nature, with the difference on the side of nature of being greater or more, and that in a degree which exceeds all computation.
Paley drives his point home with beautiful and reverent descriptions of the dissected machinery of life, beginning with the human eye, a favourite example which Darwin was later to use and which will reappear throughout this book. Paley compares the eye with a designed instrument such as a telescope and concludes that
there is precisely the same proof that the eye was made for vision as there is that the telescope was made for assisting it.
The eye must have had a designer, just as the telescope had. Paley's argument is made with passionate sincerity and is informed by the best biological scholarship of his day, but it is wrong, gloriously and utterly wrong. The analogy between telescope and eye, between watch and living organism, is false. All appearances to the contrary, the only watchmaker in nature is the blind forces of physics, albeit deployed in a very special way. A true watchmaker has foresight. He designs his cogs and springs and plans their interconnections with a future purpose in his mind's eye. Natural selection, the blind, unconscious, automatic process which Darwin discovered and which we now know is the explanation for the existence and apparently purposeful form of all life, has no purpose in mind. It has no mind and no mind's eye. It does not plan for the future. It has no vision, no foresight, no sight at all. If it can be said to play the role of watchmaker in nature, it is the blind watchmaker. I shall explain all this and much else besides, but one thing I shall not do is belittle the wonder of the living watches that so inspired Paley. On the contrary, I shall try to illustrate my feeling that here Paley could have gone even further. When it comes to feeling awe over living watches, I yield to nobody. I feel more in common with the Reverend William Paley than I do with the distinguished modern philosopher, a well-known atheist, with whom I once discussed the matter at dinner. I said that I could not imagine being an atheist at any time before 1859, when Darwin's Origin of Species was published. "What about Hume?" replied the philosopher. "How did Hume explain the organized complexity of the living world?" I asked. "He didn't," said the philosopher. "Why does it need any special explanation?" Paley knew that it needed a special explanation, Darwin knew it, and I suspect that in his heart of hearts my philosopher companion knew it too. In any case, it will be my business to show it here. As for David Hume himself, it is sometimes said that that great Scottish philosopher disposed of the argument from design a century before Darwin. But what Hume did was criticize the logic of using apparent design in nature as positive evidence for the existence of a god. He did not offer any alternative explanation for apparent design, but left the question open. An atheist before Darwin could have said, following Hume,
I have no explanation for complex biological design. All I know is that God isn't a good explanation, so we must wait and hope that somebody comes up with a better one.
I can't help feeling that such a position, though logically sound, would have left one feeling pretty unsatisfied, and that, although atheism might have been logically tenable before Darwin, Darwin made it possible to be an intellectually fulfilled atheist. I like to think that Hume would agree, but some of his writings suggest that he underestimated the complexity and beauty of biological design. The boy naturalist Charles Darwin could have shown him a thing or two about that, but Hume had been dead 40 years when Darwin enrolled in Hume's University of Edinburgh. I have talked glibly of complexity and of apparent design as though it were obvious what these words mean. In a sense, it is obvious. Most people have an intuitive idea of what complexity means. But these notions, complexity and design, are so pivotal to this book that I must try to capture a little more precisely in words our feeling that there is something special about complex and apparently design things.
So what is a complex thing? How should we recognize it? In what sense is it true to say that a watch or an airliner or an earwig or a person is complex, but the moon is simple? The first point that might occur to us as a necessary attribute of a complex thing is that it has a heterogeneous structure. A pink milk pudding or blancmange is simple in the sense that if we slice it in two, the two portions will have the same internal constitution. A blancmange is homogeneous. A car is heterogeneous. Unlike a blancmange, almost any portion of the car is different from other portions. Two times half a car does not make a car. This will often amount to saying that a complex object, as opposed to a simple one, has many parts, these parts being of more than one kind.
Such heterogeneity, or many-partedness, may be a necessary condition, but it is not sufficient. Plenty of objects are many-parted and heterogeneous in internal structure without being complex in the sense in which I want to use the term. Mont Blanc, for instance, consists of many different kinds of rock, all jumbled together in such a way that, if you slice the mountain anywhere, the two portions would differ from each other in their internal constitution. Mont Blanc has a heterogeneity of structure not possessed by a blancmange, but it is still not complex in the sense in which a biologist uses the term. Let us try another tack in our quest for a definition of complexity and make use of the mathematical idea of probability. Suppose we try out the following definition.
A complex thing is something whose constituent parts are arranged in a way that is unlikely to have arisen by chance alone.
To borrow an analogy from an eminent astronomer, if you take the parts of an airliner and jumble them up at random, the likelihood that you would happen to assemble a working Boeing is vanishingly small. There are billions of possible ways of putting together the bits of an airliner, and only one, or very few of them, would actually be an airliner. There are even more ways of putting together the scrambled parts of a human.
This approach to a definition of complexity is promising, but something more is still needed. There are billions of ways of throwing together the bits of Mont Blanc, it might be said, and only one of them is Mont Blanc. So what is it that makes the airliner and the human complicated if Mont Blanc is simple? Any old jumbled collection of parts is unique and, with hindsight, is as improbable as any other. The scrap heap at an aircraft breaker's yard is unique. No two scrap heaps are the same. If you start throwing fragments of aeroplanes into heaps, the odds of your happening to hit upon exactly the same arrangement of junk twice are just about as low as the odds of your throwing together a working airliner. So why don't we say that a rubbish dump, or Mont Blanc, or the moon, is just as complex as an aeroplane or a dog, because in all these cases the arrangement of atoms is improbable.
The combination lock on my bicycle has 4,096 different positions. Every one of these is equally improbable in the sense that if you spin the wheels at random, every one of the 4,096 positions is equally unlikely to turn up. I can spin the wheels at random, look at whatever number is displayed, and exclaim with hindsight, "How amazing! The odds against that number appearing are 4,096-1. A minor miracle." That is equivalent to regarding the particular arrangement of rocks in a mountain or of bits of metal in a scrap heap as complex. But one of those 4,096 wheel positions really is interestingly unique. The combination 1,207 is the only one that opens the lock. The uniqueness of 1,207 has nothing to do with hindsight. It is specified in advance by the manufacturer. If you spun the wheels at random and happened to hit 1,207 first time, you would be able to steal the bike, and it would seem a minor miracle. If you struck lucky on one of those multi-dial combination locks on bank safes, it would seem a very major miracle, for the odds against it are many millions to one, and you would be able to steal a fortune.
Now, hitting upon the lucky number that opens the bank safe is the equivalent, in our analogy, of hurling scrap metal around at random and happening to assemble a Boeing 747. Of all the millions of unique, and with hindsight, equally improbable positions of the combination lock, only one opens the lock. Similarly, of all the millions of unique, and with hindsight, equally improbable arrangements of a heap of junk, only one, or very few, will fly. The uniqueness of the arrangement that flies, or that opens the safe, is nothing to do with hindsight. It is specified in advance. The lock manufacturer fixed the combination, and he has told the bank manager. The ability to fly is a property of an airliner that we specify in advance. If we see a plane in the air, we can be sure that it was not assembled by randomly throwing scrap metal together, because we know that the odds against a random conglomeration's being able to fly are too great. Now, if you consider all possible ways in which the rocks of Mont Blanc could have been thrown together, it is true that only one of them would make Mont Blanc as we know it. But Mont Blanc as we know it is defined with hindsight. Any one of a very large number of ways of throwing rocks together would be labelled a mountain and might have been named Mont Blanc. There's nothing special about the particular Mont Blanc that we know, nothing specified in advance, nothing equivalent to the plane taking off, or equivalent to the safe door swinging open and the money tumbling out.
What is the equivalent of the safe door swinging open or the plane flying in the case of a living body? Well, sometimes it is almost literally the same. Swallows fly. As we've seen, it isn't easy to throw together a flying machine. If you took all the cells of a swallow and put them together at random, the chance that the resulting object would fly is not, for everyday purposes, different from zero. Not all living things fly, but they do other things that are just as improbable and just as specifiable in advance. Whales don't fly, but they do swim, and swim about as efficiently as swallows fly. The chance that a random conglomeration of whale cells would swim, let alone swim as fast and efficiently as a whale actually does swim, is negligible.
At this point, some hawk-eyed philosopher — hawks have very acute eyes, you couldn't make a hawk's eye by throwing lenses and light-sensitive cells together at random — will start mumbling something about a circular argument. Swallows fly, but they don't swim, and whales swim, but they don't fly. It is with hindsight that we decide whether to judge the success of our random conglomeration as a swimmer or as a flyer. Suppose we agree to judge its success as an Xer and leave open exactly what X is until we've tried throwing cells together. The random lump of cells might turn out to be an efficient burrower, like a mole, or an efficient climber, like a monkey. It might be very good at windsurfing, or at clutching oily rags, or at walking in ever-decreasing circles until it vanished. The list could go on and on.
Or could it? If the list really could go on, the hypothetical philosopher might have a point. If, no matter how randomly you threw matter around, the resulting conglomeration could often be said, with hindsight, to be good for something, then it would be true to say that I cheated over the swallow and the whale. But biologists can be much more specific than that about what would constitute being good for something. The minimum requirement for us to recognize an object as an animal or plant is that it should succeed in making a living of some sort, more precisely that it, or at least some members of its kind, should live long enough to reproduce. It is true that there are quite a number of ways of making a living, flying, swimming, swinging through the trees, and so on. But however many ways there may be of being alive, it is certain that there are vastly more ways of being dead, or rather not alive. You may throw cells together at random over and over again for a billion years, and not once will you get a conglomeration that flies or swims or burrows or runs or does anything, even badly, that could remotely be construed as working to keep itself alive.
This has been quite a long, drawn-out argument, and it's time to remind ourselves of how we got into it in the first place. We were looking for a precise way to express what we mean when we refer to something as complicated. We were trying to put a finger on what it is that humans and moles and earthworms and airliners and watches have in common with each other, but not with Blancmange or Mont Blanc or the moon. The answer we have arrived at is that complicated things have some quality, specifiable in advance, that is highly unlikely to have been acquired by random chance alone. In the case of living things, the quality that is specified in advance is, in some sense, proficiency. Either proficiency in a particular ability, such as flying, as an aero engineer might admire it, or proficiency in something more general, such as the ability to stave off death, or the ability to propagate genes in reproduction.
Staving off death is a thing that you have to work at. Left to itself, and that is what it is when it dies, the body tends to revert to a state of equilibrium with its environment. If you measure some quantity such as the temperature, the acidity, the water content, or the electrical potential in a living body, you will typically find that it is markedly different from the corresponding measure in the surroundings. Our bodies, for instance, are usually hotter than our surroundings, and in cold climates they have to work hard to maintain the differential. When we die, the work stops, the temperature differential starts to disappear, and we end up the same temperature as our surroundings. Not all animals work so hard to avoid coming into equilibrium with their surrounding temperature, but all animals do some comparable work. For instance, in a dry country, animals and plants work to maintain the fluid content of their cells, work against a natural tendency for water to flow from them into the dry outside world. If they fail, they die. More generally, if living things didn't work actively to prevent it, they would eventually merge into their surroundings and cease to exist as autonomous beings. That is what happens when they die.
With the exception of artificial machines, which we've already agreed to count as honorary living things, non-living things don't work in this sense. They accept the forces that tend to bring them into equilibrium with their surroundings. Mont Blanc, to be sure, has existed for a long time and probably will exist for a while yet, but it does not work to stay in existence. When rock comes to rest under the influence of gravity, it just stays there. No work has to be done to keep it there. Mont Blanc exists, and it will go on existing until it wears away or an earthquake knocks it over. It doesn't take steps to repair wear and tear, or to right itself when it's knocked over, the way a living body does. It just obeys the ordinary laws of physics.
Is this to deny that living things obey the laws of physics? Certainly not. There is no reason to think that the laws of physics are violated in living matter. There is nothing supernatural, no life force, to rival the fundamental forces of physics. It is just that if you try to use the laws of physics in a naive way to understand the behaviour of a whole living body, you will find that you don't get very far. The body is a complex thing with many constituent parts, and to understand its behaviour, you must apply the laws of physics to its parts, not to the whole. The behaviour of the body as a whole will then emerge as a consequence of interactions of the parts. Take the laws of motion, for instance. If you throw a dead bird into the air, it will describe a graceful parabola, exactly as physics books say it should, then come to rest on the ground and stay there. It behaves as a solid body of particular mass and wind resistance ought to behave.
But if you throw a live bird in the air, It will not describe a parabola and come to rest on the ground. It will fly away and may not touch land this side of the county boundary. The reason is that it has muscles which work to resist gravity and other physical forces bearing upon the whole body. The laws of physics are being obeyed within every cell of the muscles. The result is that the muscles move the wings in such a way that the bird stays aloft. The bird is not violating the law of gravity. It is constantly being pulled downwards by gravity, but its wings are performing active work, obeying laws of physics within its muscles, to keep it aloft in spite of the force of gravity. We shall think that it defies a physical law if we are naive enough to treat it simply as a structureless lump of matter with a certain mass and wind resistance. It is only when we remember that it has many internal parts, all obeying laws of physics at their own level, that we understand the behaviour of the whole body. That is not, of course, a peculiarity of living things. It applies to all man-made machines and potentially applies to any complex, many-parted object.
This brings me to the final topic that I want to discuss in this rather philosophical chapter, the problem of what we mean by explanation. We have seen what we are going to mean by a complex thing, but what kind of explanation will satisfy us if we wonder how a complicated machine or living body works? The answer is the one that we arrived at in the previous paragraph. If we wish to understand how a machine or living body works, we look to its component parts and ask how they interact with each other. If there is a complex thing that we do not yet understand, we can come to understand it in terms of simpler parts that we do already understand. If I ask an engineer how a steam engine works, I have a pretty fair idea of the general kind of answer that would satisfy me. Like Julian Huxley, I should definitely not be impressed if the engineer said it was propelled by force locomotif. And if he started boring on about the whole being greater than the sum of its parts, I would interrupt him. Never mind about that, tell me how it works. What I would want to hear is something about how the parts of an engine interact with each other to produce the behaviour of the whole engine. I would initially be prepared to accept an explanation in terms of quite large subcomponents whose own internal structure and behaviour might be quite complicated and as yet unexplained. The units of an initially satisfying explanation could have names like firebox, boiler, cylinder, piston, steam governor. The engineer would assert, without explanation initially, what each of these units does. I would accept this for the moment, without asking how each unit does its own particular thing. Given that the units each do their particular thing, I can then understand how they interact to make the whole engine move. Of course, I am then at liberty to ask how each part works. Having previously accepted the fact that the steam governor regulates the flow of steam, and having used this fact in my understanding of the behaviour of the whole engine, I now turn my curiosity on the steam governor itself. I now want to understand how it achieves its own behaviour in terms of its own internal parts. There is a hierarchy of subcomponents within components.
We explain the behaviour of a component at any given level in terms of interactions between subcomponents whose own internal organisation, for the moment, is taken for granted. We peel our way down the hierarchy until we reach units so simple that for everyday purposes we no longer feel the need to ask questions about them. Rightly or wrongly, for instance, most of us are happy about the properties of rigid rods of iron, and we're prepared to use them as units of explanation of more complex machines that contain them. Physicists, of course, do not take iron rods for granted. They ask why they are rigid, and they continue the hierarchical peeling for several more layers yet, down to fundamental particles and quarks. But life is too short for most of us to follow them. For any given level of complex organisation, satisfying explanations may normally be attained if we peel the hierarchy down one or two layers from our starting layer, but not more. The behaviour of a motor car is explained in terms of cylinders, carburettors and sparking plugs. It is true that each one of these components rests atop a pyramid of explanations at lower levels. But if you asked me how a motor car worked, you would think me somewhat pompous if I answered in terms of Newton's laws and the laws of thermodynamics, and downright obscurantist if I answered in terms of fundamental particles. It's doubtless true that at bottom the behaviour of a motor car is to be explained in terms of interactions between fundamental particles. But it is much more useful to explain it in terms of interactions between pistons, cylinders, and sparking plugs. The behaviour of a computer can be explained in terms of interactions between semiconductor electronic gates, and the behaviour of these, in turn, is explained by physicists at yet lower levels. But for most purposes, you would in practice be wasting your time if you tried to understand the behaviour of the whole computer at either of those levels. There are too many electronic gates and too many interconnections between them. A satisfying explanation has to be in terms of a manageably small number of interactions. This is why, if we want to understand the workings of computers, we prefer a preliminary explanation in terms of about half a dozen major subcomponents: memory, processing mill, backing store, control unit, input-output handler, etc. Having grasped the interactions between the half-dozen major components, we then may wish to ask questions about the internal organization of these major components. Only specialist engineers are likely to go down to the level of AND gates and NOR gates, and only physicists will go down further to the level of how electrons behave in a semiconducting medium.
For those that like ism sorts of names, the aptest name for my approach to understanding how things work is probably hierarchical reductionism. If you read trendy intellectual magazines, you may have noticed that reductionism is one of those things, like sin, that is only mentioned by people who are against it. To call oneself a reductionist will sound in some circles a bit like admitting to eating babies. But just as nobody actually eats babies, so nobody is really a reductionist, in any sense worth being against. The non-existent reductionist, the sort that everybody is against but who exists only in their imaginations, tries to explain complicated things directly in terms of the smallest parts, even, in some extreme versions of the myth, as the sum of the parts. The hierarchical reductionist, on the other hand, explains a complex entity at any particular level in the hierarchy of organization in terms of entities only one level down the hierarchy, entities which themselves are likely to be complex enough to need further reducing to their own component parts, and so on. It goes without saying, though the mythical baby-eating reductionist is reputed to deny this, that the kinds of explanations which are suitable at high levels in the hierarchy are quite different from the kinds of explanations which are suitable at lower levels. This was the point of explaining cars in terms of carburettors rather than quarks. But the hierarchical reductionist believes that carburettors are explained in terms of smaller units, which are explained in terms of smaller units, which are ultimately explained in terms of the smallest of fundamental particles. Reductionism, in this sense, is just another name for an honest desire to understand how things work. We began this section by asking what kind of explanation for complicated things would satisfy us. We have just considered the question from the point of view of mechanism. How does it work? We concluded that the behaviour of a complicated thing should be explained in terms of interactions between its component parts, considered as successive layers of an orderly hierarchy. But another kind of question is how the complicated thing came into existence in the first place. This is the question that this whole book is particularly concerned with, so I won't say much more about it here. I shall just mention that the same general principle applies as for understanding mechanism. A complicated thing is one whose existence we do not feel inclined to take for granted, because it is too improbable. It could not have come into existence in a single act of chance. We shall explain its coming into existence as a consequence of gradual, cumulative, step-by-step transformations from simpler things, from primordial objects sufficiently simple to have come into being by chance. Just as big-step reductionism cannot work as an explanation of mechanism and must be replaced by a series of small step-by-step peelings down through the hierarchy, so we can't explain a complex thing as originating in a single step. we must again resort to a series of small steps, this time arranged sequentially in time. In his beautifully written book, The Creation, the Oxford physical chemist Peter Atkins begins,
"I shall take your mind on a journey. It is a journey of comprehension, taking us to the edge of space, time, and understanding.